This is Jack Reed, recorded at his home in Seaward's End, Saffron Walden in Essex, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 12th of March 2010. Jack Reed, Part 2.
What I thought I'd do now, Jack, is I've got some of the bass reports from your period on my lap, and I'll throw up one or two quotes from it, and you can see how much of this you can remember.
Yeah, sure.
What I was talking about earlier was, this is all to do with bass F, which is Argentine, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. Yep.
You transferred there in for your second year.
Beginning of 49.
Yeah. And the supply of dog food was very, very low at that point, according to the bass report. And you were reduced to killing penguins and also killing skuas to feed the dogs. But they were also concerned about human food as well. Owing to the unusual early season, I, the base commander, was getting a little anxious about our food supply at the base. We had sufficient food to last another year, but it only consisted of the bare essentials, such as corned beef, biscuits and herring, and a few other items. Items such as sugar, butter, milk and flour would have lasted for just two more months. So it was a great relief when the Bisco finally arrived on the 25th of March, and dropped anchor. Now, do you remember any tension about that at the time?
No, I remember nothing at all about that, actually. Neither about our food or the dog's food.
It looks like you could have ended up doing another year if the Bisco hadn't arrived.
Well, yes, as I say, the previous year they'd done another year at Marguerite Bay. And this year, the 49... there was every intention of getting the people out from Marguerite Bay. So we were the next base to Marguerite Bay. So the Bisco, I don't think anything else was involved. The Bisco, along with an aircraft flown by a Canadian pilot, they both operated from the Argentines.
Was this the Norseman aeroplane?
The Norseman, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I can't think of the name of the Canadian pilot, but they both the ship and the Norseman, and were based at the Argentines. And I don't know how many times they tried to get down to Marguerite Bay. I just can't remember actually. But I know on the last trip, I went down with them because I was then due to be transferred anyway. So I went down on the Bisco to Marguerite Bay. When we got the last of the blokes out.
So you were this was the so-called Lost 11, wasn't it, including
yeah,
John Huckle?
That's right. Yeah.
So you were on the Bisco.
The Bisco when we did the trip to bring the last blokes out. Yeah, we'd had some out by aircraft.
By the Norsemen.
That's right. But the bulk of them, and of course all their records and everything else, samples and what have you, had to be brought out on the Bisco. And yes, and we did that in the spring of 49.
Was it touch and go?
Sorry, I'm just reflecting a bit. It was 50, actually, we did that, not 49.
Right,
50.
Yeah.
Touch and go. The only real bad ice we found was Marguerite Bay, which was absolutely solid. But we broke our way through it over the course of a day or so and got to the base quite easily. No, it was quite all right once you got away from the base. It was just drift ice generally, but the base was certainly the bay at the base was absolutely solid. But we broke through there anyway.
Do you remember seeing the men being brought aboard
from
Stonington, the Lost 11,
from Marguerite Bay? Yeah. Yes, I do. Oh yes, I mean I went ashore and I no doubt gave hands to various people bringing their baggage out or samples or anything else that was required. Yeah, we were there for a few days loading up the Bisco.
What condition were they in, physically and spiritually?
Well, much as some of them had spent an extra year there, that main 3 years total, no, I didn't notice that. I can't remember any particular difference about them, no. No.
They took it in their stride, didn't they?
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the big jobs at the second base, at base F, was to extend the base, wasn't it, at Argentina?
That's right.
Now, was this a carefully orchestrated scheme, or was it a bit make it up as you go along?
What we had to do, what we wanted to do, was extend the radio cabin into something. I can't go for the life. We think what we wanted to extend it into, because we had a very, it was a very small hut. It was only about 14 or 15 feet square, I suppose. Yeah, and we did extend it, but I can't for the life of me think why.
An extension had to be built onto the hut. It was decided to build on the west side, furthest away from the engine room, as the extension was to be used mainly for the new wireless room.
That's right. Yeah, for Dennis's wireless room. That was it. Yeah, so the extension, I would have said, was about 8 foot out from the hut and about 10 or 12 foot long. So we had timber come down, which we built a framework, and then we put the bits we built onto it. Yes, yeah. I mean, all four of us worked on it, so I don't know what it had taken us, a month or so, I suppose.
And you had to put the foundations in first, didn't you?
Yeah, we had to put foundations in. Yes.
By the end of April, work on the extension, the Nissen hut, the engine room and the general base work was completed, which enabled you to spend more time training the dogs. That was
yep.
good.
Yep.
And then there was some talk about ringing birds as well. Was that something you were involved in?
Well, the only ringing I ever did, as I said, was with Bill Sladen when he came down on board the ship. Now, whether that was the time when the ship came to us on its way to Marguerite Bay, I really can't remember. But certainly I did some with Bill Sladen, yes.
What were you doing? Do you know why you were doing it?
Just to keep a record of they were penguins we were ringing, just to keep a record of the penguins in the area, yeah.
Was it fun, or was it quite tricky?
it can be awkward at times trying to catch the things and hold them, but, I mean, putting the ring on is no problem. But, yes, like any other job, I suppose, you get the good bits and the bad bits.
Yeah. Did he get to know Bill Sladen?
Yes, I got to know him quite well. I thought I liked Bill, yes. He's a nice chap.
Tell me about him. What was good about him? What is good about him?
He was a relatively quiet bloke, but I would have thought very organised. In fact, the fact that he finished up at Hope Bay on his own must have really brought that home to him in a big way when the other three blokes died in the fire. He was just a very nice, controlled bloke, yes. He hadn't got too much medical work to do. Obviously, people down there have to get outside their own professions. And, I feel certain it was Bill I was doing this with. It was one of his professions, was to work on seals and birds, anything else that came his way, as long as it was alive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here we are again, quoting from the base report from Base F in the 49-50 season. Okay. The next trip we made was by Reed and myself in September. This is September 1950, I guess.
49.
We went north with our teams to the Weddell Islands. Open water was seen north and northeast of Hovgaard Island. The party sledged south to Petermann Island, where a cairn and a plaque of Charcot's was found. Do you remember that day?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, very much.
What can you tell me about it?
The islands were about 20 miles north of the Argentines, I suppose, and we hauled in there, and there was a plaque which had been erected over a memorial site which had fallen down. It had broken. So we decided we wouldn't leave it there because it might get lost completely. So we put it on the sledge. We either put it on the sledge then, although I suspect we left it and then picked it up on our return back to base. And then we came back to this country. And then there was a bit of a kerfuffle arose. I can't quite think of the details now, but we'd brought the plaque back with the request it be passed over to the French for them to renew it and reinstall it, or we'd reinstall it after they renewed it. And there was a bit of a kerfuffle came up about somebody had pinched this thing and they didn't realise that we'd taken it away to preserve it. But, yes, it eventually went back onto the islands, I gather, the next year, I expect.
Was it in poor condition then?
Yes, it was, yes. It was a wooden one which with a metal plate on, if I remember correctly, which had got in a bit of a bad state, yes.
Mm.
So it was rebuilt, or renewed, and put back on the site the following year, no doubt.
What was it like to be stepping onto the spot where Sharko had stepped himself half a century before you? Did you recognise it as being a romantic or a significant moment?
No, I don't think so. Not in that particular case. I think that being a great fan of the British Groundland Expedition, I'd got very used to walking in their footsteps and appreciating all the work they'd done. And I'm afraid that that might as well have led me on to accepting Sharko and any other person who was down there in the same way as I accepted the BGLE.
So he wasn't a hero figure as far as you were concerned?
No, not particularly, no. No.
And you found two previously unmarked islands as well, according to here.
Yeah, it could be. I can't remember much about that.
Crossing the Panola Straits, two small uncharted islets were found under the ice cliff.
Yeah, they were on the mainland. I can remember we went there, actually. at one time, we did have it in mind to climb the glacier up on the western face of Graham Land and get on top. But we decided it was quite out of the question. We couldn't do it. But yes, we did come across a couple of small uncharted islands.
The reports I'm reading... there's a comment from Miles Clifton at the end. It's almost like a school teacher marking the report.
Mm-hmm.
His handwriting and his scribbles are all over the place, all over this report, which isn't terribly well written. And Clifford says, this is a very ill-written report and should have been checked before submission to me. This comes of leaving things to the last minute. And you're laughing. Was that classic... Miles Clifford behaviour?
No, I don't think it was classic Miles Clifford as an individual, but I can well imagine it would be a classic remark from a civil servant who sort of suddenly was faced by that report, which of course explains itself away when he said it was written at the last moment. You have to leave things to the last moment under those conditions. You can't write that sort of report halfway through the year. You've got to wait almost till the ship is just about coming round the corner of the island next door to you before you write it, you see.
So you can't write instalments then as such?
Not really.
No. Okay. Well, we won't embarrass the person by naming who it was who wrote it. In your film, Jack, I saw something I'd never seen before or was not aware of in the Antarctic, and that is keeping dogs in cages. That seems a very strange thing to do.
Yes, it was purely an experimental idea which Fids came up with. Now, who that would be, I don't know. That might well have been, wouldn't have been Fuchs because he was with us, but the chappie who ran Fids from this end would have been Ken Butler. Now, it might have been Ken Butler's idea, I don't know. It could well have been. But we had these cages, as you say, sent down. They were panels which were all about 6 or 8 feet high and about 10 foot square. And we made them up. We had four cages of that size, if I remember correctly. And the idea was that we would take the dogs off the spans and let them go into the cages either on their own or with a mate, if they could put up with a mate. And we did it, but it didn't seem to lead anywhere at all, actually.
Was it more sociable to do that, do you think, for the dogs?
Well, I would have thought life was better for them, because when they were on the span, they were on a 6 foot wire from the main span, so they naturally only move 6 foot in any direction. That must have been restrictive, I suppose, although they'd done it most of their lives, they may have got used to it. Whereas when they were let into the kennel, they could either be on their own or with a mate. But of course, the drawback to that, I would have thought was possibly that, having got used to living on a span with a dog either side of you and one to the dog either side of you, you may have felt very lonely and on your own when you were put into a kennel, into a cage. Yeah. So I'm not certain what the answer is. I think possibly the answer was that it wasn't worth doing.
Well, it didn't catch on, did it?
No, it was never continued. We were the only base to have them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing, but we didn't see any advantage for it at all, actually. Yeah. And I don't think the dogs did.
There's another report here on your sledging reports. This is a depot laying journey in June 1949.
That was our midwinter's one, then?
Yes, it would have been, yes.
Yep.
I can tell you that it was June 26th, 27th. The very low temperatures recorded of minus 51 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
This is believed to be an all-time record for this part of Grahamland.
Yeah.
Do you remember that night?
Oh, yeah, I do very much. We laid in the blooming bed, and it really was cold in the sleeping bag. And also, it was somewhere about that time when I was unwell, and I had to be left in there for the day when the others went back to pick up the sledges and bring them back up to base again.
2 days earlier.
Yeah, was it? Okay.
25th of June.
The temperature was about the same.
Reed was feeling very seedy at first, yeah, with a slight case of primus fumes.
Yeah.
So he was left behind whilst Tate and I went back to collect the depot.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
He felt much better in the evening.
Yeah.
So what happened there?
Well, what I'd done, I'd made a mistake. When you get up and light the stove, ready to start cooking breakfast and also to get it warmer so you can get out of bed, I'd stood up too quickly and my head had gone into the peak of the tent, which was full of smoke. And that's when I'd taken in a dose of smoke, and that's what had caught me out.
Right.
I shouldn't have put my head that high up into the peak of the tent.
This was a bell tent or a...
No, pyramid tent.
Pyramid tent, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that knocked you out for the best part of the day, did it?
Yes. There must be other things which we get in a civilised world, I'm certain, where you get affected by fumes or gas, yes, that's right, which sort of really makes you feel completely unwell, possibly sick, and really unable to do much at all until you sleep it off.
Yeah. Tell me about trying to sleep in temperatures of minus 51. It must be... I mean, what can you do? 51 Fahrenheit, we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, the bags we had were beautiful. To my knowledge, or to my memory, there's nothing you can do extra than get into the bag and go to sleep, or try to go to sleep. All you've got is just a hole left like that, you see.
Around your face.
So there's no chance of cold air getting in. And, during the night, it was no problem at all. We used to sleep quite happily under any temperature conditions. But it was during the day when... as I was ill, or as you may have been caught out by the weather and forced to stop in a tent for during the day, that's when it seemed to be so hard. I'm not quite certain why it was, actually, just that I suppose we weren't used to doing it during the day. We were awake during that period and possibly more conscious of the cold because of that.
So were you actually warm inside these sleeping bags?
Oh, yeah, lovely. Oh, yeah.
They were?
Oh, yes.
What were they made of?
I don't know what they were made of, but they were beautiful bags, yes. I mean, as you can imagine, that at that time... not everything was beautifully done. The bags were beautifully done. Most of our clothing was ex-army. Now, if you went to the Highlands of Scotland or Norway with some of the clothing, it'd been ideal, but it wasn't much cop when you were down south. But the bags, no, they were beautifully done. They were bought from one of the big London stores, no doubt, that specialised in climbing and camping gear.
So you were actually warm at minus 51 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And did not your nose freeze or get frostbite if it was out sticking out from the bag? Or was it actually quite warm in the tent as well?
No, it wasn't warm in the tent, no, because, I mean, we turned the stove off. So yeah. within an hour, well, within half an hour, in fact, it has gone down to the same temperature outside. Yes, I think we used to get stuff on the outside of the sleeping bag, but not much. Yeah.
Mm. So in the daytime when you were sledging, and I guess it got a bit warmer than minus 51, but...
Yes, it did. I mean, it come up to about 40, say, minus 40. But you're on the go the whole time. You don't really get much chance to get cold when you're out there.
Hmm. It was so cold, the radio batteries froze and you couldn't communicate.
That's right, right. Yeah, we couldn't.
This particular trip, though, it was regarded as a failure in the end because it was not completed. You did 8 days out... from base with only 15 days of food supplies left, so the decision was made to come back again.
Yeah.
So you never made it to your destination, which was to lay some depots.
That's right, yeah.
Which must have been frustrating, I would have thought.
Well, yes, it was because, the depots we were laying were for our future work, and if you can't lay them, I mean, that's going to curtail your future work anyway.
Mm.
But there's nothing much we could do about it under those conditions.
Was there a sense of failure, or was it just an adventure anyway?
I don't think we had a sense of... there was no sense of failure. There was a sense of not succeeding, maybe, or of not getting as far as we wanted to, or doing as well as we wanted to. But, no, failure is a bit of a strong word, actually, to use.
Okay. There's another sledging report here, which is later in the year when he went south. This is in November 1949.
Mm-hmm.
The objective was to pick up and move the depot, which was laid on the sea house south of Lahil Island.
Yeah.
Lahil Island.
Yeah.
To observe the ice to the south, to visit as many islands as possible, collecting specimens of rock en route, and to make observations on seals and birds. So we set out from base with Reed driving two teams. And Clifford has written, that's very clever of him, in Byron, in pen.
Yeah, no, that's not quite right. It would have been, I set out with Reed driving two teams. Nicol, you see, drove the number one team and I drove the number two.
Yeah.
So Nicol, who wrote the report, should have said, Reed and I, or I set out with Reed.
Okay.
I didn't know that one, actually.
Several of the dog pemmican boxes had leaked, so the contents were swollen and became useless. So Clifford has written, I presume he means that water got into them. Why? Surely they were proofed. And at one point you got down to, there was a blinding snowstorm one morning. Sledging was down to, visibility was down to 20 yards.
Yeah.
But nevertheless you carried on. Working off a compass.
Well, you work off a compass, yes. You can do it under those conditions because you haven't got things to avoid. You can't also see things and you can't make a decision to go to a particular point because you can't see it, but at least you can get another few miles nearer to it.
Yeah.
So that when the weather does clear, you're that much nearer home or nearer the base or whatever you want.
The implication in that report is the dogs knew where to go, even if you couldn't see yourselves where to go. Or is that a romantic notion?
No, I don't think so. Mark you, the dogs wouldn't have known where to go because they hadn't been there before. But nevertheless, once you've got them lined up and set on a course, they normally keep to it very accurately.
Right. They've got an inbuilt compass.
Something of that sort, yes. I mean, they don't twist and turn much at all, no.
Mm, interesting. There's one or two things in your film which I quite enjoyed as well, raise one or two questions that we haven't already discussed. There's a sequence of film about the brakes on the sledges, which I found unusual. There's rope brakes, is that right? The sledges seem to have ropes underneath
them. I see what you mean. Yes, there are two brakes on sledges. On the normal one, you've got a rod that sticks out at the back with a foot pedal on and a metal bar, and as you stand on it, that acts as a brake. But that only does for slowing the sledge down. If you're going to come down a very steep slope and you want to make certain that you can control the sledge and not have it run away from you, You turn the sledge on its side and you wire. You turn rope around each of the runners, so that when it goes, it doesn't run at all easily, so it can't run away from you.
But that must hamper it going uphill.
Oh, you could then, but yeah, when you got to the bottom, you've then got to put the sledge over on its side
and take the ropes off again and
coil them up on the handlebars.
So it's rather like pinning down the brakes for a descent on a truck,
yeah,
isn't it?
That's right.
Okay. And there's also some film of this greenhouse where, according to one of the reports, you were growing tobacco, but you don't seem to remember that.
I knew we grew various things in the greenhouse, yes. Mm. It was a nice little greenhouse on the northern side of the hut, yes. And we did grow various things in there, but I can't think what.
Yeah. Okay. Just looking back at that period in your life now, Jack, I mean, most FIDs I talk to seem to regard it as being one of the more significant periods of their life. Is that the case for you?
I would go along with that, yes. Yeah.
Just summarise why it was so significant, if you can.
I think because it's so different. I think because you were lucky enough to be accepted and put onto it. Because you were doing something which you'd never done before, and you had to learn as you went along. It was just a complete education in its own right, actually. Yeah.
When the time came to go, what were your feelings at that point? Did you want to stay on longer, or had you had enough?
Well, of course, the only way you can stay on longer is for another year. And I don't think I would have wanted to stay on for another year. I'd had two wonderful years. And I don't think I'd have wanted to stay on for another year. I'd like to have come back and then gone down again, possibly. But that's a different kettle of fish altogether.
That never happened, though?
It didn't happen, no.
No.
The nearest I got to going back was that when we came back, we brought a team of dogs back with us, or a number of dogs, and it was suggested, if I was available, that I might do some dog driving at the Festival of Britain show.
In 51, in
London. But no, I wasn't available. I'd gone away after that, so I didn't get the chance.
Hmm. So you left the Antarctic. You went south of Stonington. That was your last sort of...
That's Stonington was... Yeah, we may have called into other bases on the way north up to the Falklands, but certainly Stonington was the last active working base we visited, yes.
And when the ship turned north for the last time, how did you feel about it? Were you glad to get out, or were you very sad to
leave? No. No, I think that... it's nice to come out, because you're going back, you'll be seeing the family, and you'll be seeing a world which you haven't seen for 2 years and which you've heard nothing about at all. I mean, we had no television. We don't know what went on. No, it was going to be quite a nice surprise to go home. But I'll go on to one more thing later on, actually, if I may now. I'll do it now, rather.
Yeah, please.
But over the course of the last 10 years, I suppose, I've had various opportunities to go south, I think, but I've never taken them up because I was so impressed with the Antarctic I knew back at the end of the 40s and the way it's changed, largely because of climate change or anything else, any other reason, but I'm very glad that I never got the I never did go down, because I think I'd have been terribly disappointed. And that was brought home particularly to me. I've got a daughter in Australia. And we used to go by aircraft or anything else. And I remember saying to the missus at one time, let's go by train to Hong Kong. It'll save a trip and it'll be a nice trip anyway. So she said, all right, fair enough. So I organised a trip to Hong Kong. Now, I'd known Hong Kong at the end of the war because I'd gone into the Royal Observatory and taken it over from the Japanese and got it running again. And that was a wonderful place. It was in the same class as Antarctica. It was a lovely, interesting place, and it was all new. Mm. But when I went back in the early 90s, I suppose, by train, I was absolutely horrified by it, that it was just a modern concrete jungle now, Hong Kong, not the beautiful place it was when I knew it. And that really brought home to me most forcibly that, for Pete's sake, never go south again, because you might have the same experience as with Hong Kong. And I've got such wonderful memories of Antarctica that to have it spoilt by going back and finding nothing but rock or huts or blooming aircraft or roads or whatever they put there now, that would have been terrific. So I've never done it. I never would do it now.
Okay. What did you do then when you got back to Blighty? First of all, had Britain changed in the 2 years you were away? Because we were still only a handful of years after the war. So did he find Britain and moved on?
My parents had moved house, which made a bit of a difference, in the same village, the same small town actually as it is now, but still in the same area, very nice. And I came back, and I must admit, the first two things I tried to do was to join either join the Royal Canadian Mounted Police or the Hudson Bay Company. And I sort of got in touch with various Canadian authorities, but nothing seemed to work for me. So I gave that one up. And I then had a mate who lived in the same village who'd gone out to India tea planting. And he must have come back on leave, I suppose, because I saw him and had a chat and it sounded all rather nice. So I got the address of his company. Duncan Brothers, they were known in Calcutta, always known locally as Drunken Brothers. So I wrote to them, and yes, they gave me a job out there.
In India?
Yeah, in India, on a tea garden, yes.
Did that become a career, or was that just a passing?
Well, I had every hope it would become a career, but I spent 2 years out there, and by which time, of course, we'd had the Indian take back the country, rightly or wrongly,
yeah.
And things had changed a lot. And I couldn't see a working life for me there. So I decided I'd pack that in and I'd come back home and I'd go to Africa, which seemed to me to offer a working life in Kenya or in any of the other tea-growing countries. But I came back here and, of course, found to my horror that there'd been an awful lot of nationalistic revolt out there of one sort or another, and I didn't see that would give me a working life anyway, so I didn't do that either.
So what direction did your career...
Well, in that case, it went on to farming.
Here?
In this country, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Or Sussex, as it happens. And I spent about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years farming, I suppose, in one place. And I finished up in managing a farm in Winchester, or just outside Winchester. And then... again, that changed a bit. The farm was taken over by a manager who... taken over by an owner, actually, who was a wee bit of an awkward bloke to work for. So I decided that maybe I couldn't put up with that too much longer. So I then left that and I joined a corn merchant's firm.
Did you ever find any use for those skills you gained in the Antarctic, either practical skills or just the experience of growing up?
Yes, I feel certain that one meets enough and does enough in the Antarctic that it must really influence your life afterwards to a certain extent.
It changes you, does it?
I think it does, yeah, I think it does.
How did it change you?
I think that would be a terrible question to answer. But I think that there is such a... it is so different down there that I feel certain that you learn different skills and different attitudes that must affect you later on. But I can't list them, I'm sorry.
You say you haven't been back, but when you hear the word Antarctic on the news or on the TV or the radio, do your ears prick up still? Is it still in your blood?
It's still in my blood from the point of view, more likely from sound than from vision. Because to me, I don't think my own sights 40 years later, but the other sights I see where I can imagine what they looked like in my days, they're totally different nowadays. Mm. I mean, the snow has gone, they've got rocks everywhere, so... No, I really don't want to see it. It would upset my memories too much.
Well, I hope I haven't upset you, Jack.
No, not at all.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's all right. Thank you. Yeah, that was very interesting.